Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Larry from Atlantic City, New Jersey.
Hey guys, how you guys doing? My name's Larry. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, there's an old Groucho Marx joke that says, I would never want to belong to any organization that would have someone like me for a member. And that's kind of what I kind of how I felt when I came into this thing. You know, I came in here and I was shaken and scared and, you know, really just a shell of a human being. And you guys welcomed me with open arms and smiles on your faces. And you told me it was going to get better. And you asked me to keep coming back. And I thought that, you know, if you guys had any idea how screwed up I actually was, you sure as hell wouldn't be passing that basket around with loose change in it, and especially not to me. But you know, that's one of the greatest gifts this fellowship's given me is, you know, it's given me people that I surround myself with that know exactly what it is that I'm feeling, know exactly what it is that I'm going through, and most importantly, know exactly what it is that's going to help me get outside of that and outside of myself. And, you know, I opened up my book today while I was sitting over here, and I happened to open up to page 71 and How It Works. And it says, you know, God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from him. And I think that's amazing. Because, you know, as time goes on and as my sobriety grows and changes, one of the things I find myself struggling with today isn't necessarily the thought of a drink. But, you know, it's improving and enhancing upon that contact with my Creator. And... you know, I think that means I have to pray a little bit harder, and I have to meditate a little bit stronger, and, you know, I got to act a little bit better, and I have to do this, and I have to do that. And it says right there, you know, I don't have to do any of that. And as a matter of fact, as soon as I stop trying to do all that, I get out of the way and let God work his magic. And it was the same way with my drinking when I came in here. You guys said... well, you know, step one, what's it say to you, Larry? And I said, well, step one says I can't drink. And a few of you nodded your heads, but most of you chuckled and said, because you realized that's not what step one said to the true alcoholic. Step one said, you know, you're guaranteed to drink under any and all circumstances when you're relying on yourself and your own power to keep yourself sober. And so, you know, just like I had to learn that that God was the only one you could take this obsession from me, still today, he's the only one who's going to help me overcome these hurdles that block me off from him. All I have to do is remain willing. And even more important than that is sometimes I don't even have to be willing, but I have to get rid of that defiance. My sponsor tells me all the time, yeah, I cannot say okay or maybe while I'm saying no. And so sometimes I just need to remember that I need to get rid of that defiance. To step aside and let God get in there and change things up. So with that, my sobriety date is July 16th of 2014, and it's not the date I would have picked. I had picked several sobriety dates before I actually got sober. And again, that was kind of me running the show. One of them happened to be my mother's birthday because, you know, as a typical selfish and self-centered alcoholic, I figured what better day to claim as my own than the birthday of my mother. But, you know, when I came in here, I had no idea that July 16th, 2014 was going to be it. And the reason why is because I had done this so many times before that I really found myself in a hopeless state of mind and body where I didn't think that there was anything that was going to change because it hadn't changed for so long. And, you know, I hear people say that they claim as first time winners coming in here and, you know, having only been to rehab one time and getting this thing. And that's not my story. You know, I've been to 9 treatment centers and countless IOPs and therapists and sober houses and stuff like that. And, you know, I stand before you and claim that I'm a first time winner. Because, you know, the first time I ever set aside, as we talked about with the prayer, what I thought I knew about these 12 steps in recovery. The first time I set that all aside and said, okay, I don't know. Please show me what it is that you guys did. I got this thing. And I'm so grateful for that. And it was a long, strange trip to get there. But you guys didn't give up. I heard it before in the rooms that Alcoholics Anonymous does not shoot its wounded, and I'm so grateful for that. So I don't know that I would be here if you guys had said, all right, Larry, you're a lost cause. As a matter of fact, every time I came back, you welcomed me with open arms and said, when you're ready, let us know. And I am grateful for that. So a little bit about what I was like. I grew up the oldest of four children. I still happen to be the oldest of four children. And I was the center of my universe, and I hope to be the center of everyone's universe around me. You know, I had everything that I needed. I had loving parents. I had supportive parents. My dad has always been my biggest cheerleader. When I was playing in bands, he would mix our sound. And when we got too old to have dad at our shows mixing our sound, then he would come up with our graphics and make posters and banners for us at work. And when we decided that, you know, spray paint and cutout letters looked better on the side of a van than any decals he made up, well, then, you know, he was in there bragging about us to his friends at work, saying, yeah, my son's off playing with his band. They're up in Boston and New York, and then they're on a week-long trip. And, you know, I resented him for all these tiny little things that he had done. Like, you know, Larry, don't get too drunk tonight. You have to go to school tomorrow. Well, actually, no, he never let me get drunk on school night. Larry, don't get too drunk tonight. You have to go to work tomorrow. You know, Larry, your mom asked you to do this. I think that instead of blowing her off for something better that's come up, maybe you honor your commitments. You know, I resented him for all the wrong reasons. Because, you know, all I could see was what I wanted and what I thought I deserved. And, you know, my mother, she's the closest thing to a saint that I've ever come across. And when I was drinking, you know, she annoyed me. I would come home plastered, and I would find her asleep on the couch. And when I would find her asleep on the couch, it was usually in one of two different ways. I would come home, and I'd find her curled up on the couch with a blanket over her, a pillow under her head, the lights dimmed and the TV off. And I know that, you know, she meant to fall asleep there. My dad tucked her in, and she went to bed, or he went to bed. And then there was the second way that I would find her, and that's I would come home, and the light would be on, the TV would be blaring. She'd be sitting upright on the couch, and when I'd open the door, she'd jolt, and she'd look at me, and a sigh of relief would come on her face, and she'd come up to me and give me a hug, and she'd say, Larry, I love you so much, don't you ever forget that, and she would go off to bed. And, you know, it was those nights that I realized I was coming home to a woman who didn't expect to fall asleep on the couch. She was up there waiting for me. To know that her son was going to make it through the night so that she could ease her worrying and go to bed, knowing that tonight's not the night she's going to lose her son. And so, you know, when I would come home and I'd find her in this way, and she would greet me with that saying, Larry, I love you so much, don't you ever forget it, I would have one of two reactions. Either I was too drunk to comprehend what she was saying. I'd say, yeah, 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 I love you too, Mom. I'd go downstairs and I'd pass out. Or I wasn't drunk enough and I could comprehend what she was saying. I'd say, yeah, Mom, I love you too, and I'd go downstairs, and I'd continue to drink until I didn't feel the guilt and shame that would well up inside of me. You know, all throughout my life, I've been way too smart for my own good, and so it started at a very early age. I think I was about in third grade when I first diagnosed myself with what I thought was clinical depression. So, you know, I'd sit there in school, and I'd have no motivation. Third grader, my third grade mind did this diagnosis, but it's all right because I diagnosed myself, so at least now I know the problem, and with my third grade intellect, I shall proceed to overcome this problem and prescribe for myself. And so, you know, I'd say, okay, I got this deep, dark depression, and I wallow in self-pity, but, you know, I'm just going to pull myself up by the bootstraps, and I'm going to do better this time. And, you know, that went on for a few years. And, you know, I might be able to fool myself into thinking that, you know, things are great around me, but they didn't last long. So, you know, a couple of years go by, and suddenly I start having all these crazy conversations in my head, and I'm just so consumed by what you're thinking about me, and, you know, with this girl over here snickering at the lunch table, and some real heavy shit for a fifth grader. And you know, I realized that, okay, the deep, dark depression isn't going away, and now all of a sudden I got this high anxiety that seems to be creeping up. But it's all right, because again, I recognize what the problem is. I'm a fifth grader with deep, dark depression and high anxiety. Might as well prescribe for myself and, you know, start taking things that might ease that pain a little bit. And so, you know, one drink turned into this, turned into that, turning into mixing it with high-powered sedatives like the book talks about. And suddenly I find myself just purely addicted and a complete mess. And by the time I was like a freshman in high school, the substances I'm doing just have me absolutely crazy in my own mind. And I'm talking to myself on a daily basis. And it's becoming apparent that not only do I have deep, dark depression coupled with high anxiety, but I'm obviously a paranoid schizophrenic. These thoughts that are going on in my mind are just absolutely insane. And they don't make any sense to me. Certainly not when I'm sober. They make a little bit more sense when I'm drunk. But again, I was a little bit afraid of being a paranoid schizophrenic. You don't see commercials that advertise a solution for that. You hear commercials that talk about depression, and here, take a Zoloft, and you know, anxiety, take a Xanax. But paranoid schizophrenia doesn't get all that much airtime. But still, you know, there's a name for it. There's a diagnosis for it, so I can obviously WebMD this and find a solution for it. And my solution came in drinking and drugging because, you know, it's the second best solution I know to my untreated alcoholism. And you know, so as my progression developed and my self-centeredness got greater, I wound up hurting many people, usually those closest to me. I've heard it so many times, you know, I hurt the people closest to me first because they were the last ones to call the cops. And, you know, when things would come to a head and it would be pointed out to me that this is a problem and the way you're acting is not the way a normal person acts, I'd be able to fake guilt and remorse pretty well. I'd be able to pull the crocodile tears out and you know, pretend that what I was doing has suddenly hit me like an epiphany, and I'd be able to make that solemn oath that I'm not going to do this anymore, and I'll fare better next time. And you're absolutely right, Mom. That was irresponsible of me. And you're absolutely right, Dad. That's your debit card, not mine. And, you know, you're absolutely right, Grandmom. Pop-Pop's on hospice and needs that pain medication. And I promise it's not going to be the same anymore. And, you know, the scariest part for me wasn't that I got caught. The scariest part for me was that in light of all this havoc and pain that I'm creating, the guilt and shame was not strong enough to keep me from going back and doing it again. Any normal person would see the pain and suffering they're causing the loved ones around them, and I'd imagine that that would be a strong enough reason to put the drink down. But for me, it wasn't. And so, you know, upon analyzing this, I realized not only do I have deep, dark depression coupled with high anxiety, not only am I a paranoid schizophrenic, but I obviously must be a sociopath. Because the things I'm doing and the remorse that I'm obviously not feeling sounds like only one thing to me, and that's a sociopath. I've looked it up on many a website, and that must be what I have, and it scared the hell out of me. And, you know, it was scary, but there was something even scarier, and that's when I continued to read the article and found out that a sociopath does not fear the fact that he's a sociopath. Someone who's antisocial does not feel remorse for being antisocial. That part of their mind is just missing. And so, you know, here I am beating myself up over this, so scared out of my wits to be labeled a sociopath like Hannibal Lecter and Jeffrey Dahmer and all these other fine citizens out there. And that thought scared me because I realized I must have something that is yet to be discovered in all the scientific literature out there and all the annals of scientific medicine. I now have a disease of the mind that has not even been discovered yet. And that means that there's no hope in me solving it. And so I think that was the first taste of powerlessness I had gotten when I realized there's something wrong with me that no one else out there has, because I don't see it described anywhere in any of this literature I'm reading. Obviously, I hadn't read this literature that just fell all over the floor, so give me one second. Let's see. Spiritual awakening. I guess I don't need that anymore. And no, I'm only kidding. So as you can see, I'd like to present this. I guess I've read the literature a little bit. So you know, walking around and thinking that there's something wrong with me that no one else knows about, that no one else has any way out of, is a sad, scary place. And, you know, college looked completely hopeless to me. I went down to school in Florida, and I had three or four different apartments in my stay down there. And every one of them was nicer than the one previous to it. And I still found it much more comfortable to sleep on the couch of an abandoned house with a couple 60-some-year-old doctor shoppers. And, you know, build up my credit with them throughout the week and remain there until payday on Friday when I could go to the bank and, you know, pay back all my bills like it talks about in Bill's story. And, you know, that's what college looked like for me. Here I was in sunny Florida in Orlando with a very nice two-bedroom apartment to myself with vaulted ceilings. And I'm sleeping on a cigarette burn-ridden couch with no electricity, with only cold running water, and I'm having the time of my life because I'm finally able to do what it is I want to do 24/7, and that was comfortable. Because for the briefest of moments, that fear of being clinically depressed with high anxiety and coupled with paranoid schizophrenia and, you know, sociopathic tendencies disappeared, and I found some relief, and it worked, and it worked for a long time. And then slowly, the amounts got greater and the effect got lessened. And you know, I think that's where we can all relate. So enough of that. Let's talk about what happened. So anyway, I went into what seemed like my 100th rehab, and it happened to be my my 9th. And at this time, I wasn't homeless, eating out of McDonald's trash cans like I had been before. I was actually able to hold down a job, unlike before. I had a vehicle. My mom had a vehicle she let me use, which was not always the case in the past. And, you know, on the outside, for a 25-year-old young man, things didn't look quite as hopeless or disappointing as they once had been. But inside, I was an absolute mess. And, you know, that complete loss of control and, you know, utter disappointment in my life became so apparent on the 9th of July, 2014, I was supposed to go meet up with my my probation officer. I was supposed to give her a sample. And, you know, the morning jitters were on me. The madness had come over me. And I took my brother's car without his permission. And, you know, all I had to do was go left, drive about 25 minutes, and provide this sample, and I'd be home free. And, you know, I'd be able to ditch and dodge the PO for another week and do what it is I wanted to do. But whatever that is that ceases to creep into my mind and to deter me, it took hold that morning. So I got in the car, and I turned right, and I went into North Camden, and I got what it is that I always get, I did what I always did, and I woke up 45 minutes later, parked in some back lot, with my phone ringing off the hook. And my brother was pissed because he was now late for work. My father was upset because he's seen this multiple times before, and he knows exactly where I am. My probation officer was calling me saying, "Larry, you missed your appointment." And my mother was calling me from work saying, "Where are you now?" And so, again, you know, like every responsible 25-year-old, when shit hits the fan, I say, "Okay, you know what, you guys deal with this for me, please. I'm going to go back to rehab." And I walked into my 9th rehab, and things seemed utterly hopeless. And as soon as they got me on those detox meds, and, you know, they put a couple meals in me, and they let me sleep for a day and a half, that old fierce determination to win came back again. And I was pretty sure that all I needed was a 7-day fix me up, you know, detox a little bit, get the habit down, the weight up, and you know, I'll fare better next time. And so I went to my counselor in rehab, and I decided to tell him my grand idea that I was going to walk back from Bridgeton, New Jersey to Hamilton, New Jersey to prove to everyone how badly I wanted to stay sober. And I know it doesn't mean much to you, but that's a 45-minute drive for anyone who's from South Jersey, and I was willing to walk that 5 or 6 days detoxed to prove how badly I wanted to stay sober. And, you know, in this rehab, they have you sign a 24-hour release sheet that says, you know, here's 24 hours, develop a game plan to get him to stay, because as soon as that 24th hour hits, he's out the door. And so I knew what everyone in the facility was doing. They were probably getting together and, you know, coming up with a strategy to convince me to stay, because obviously all they want is my insurance money. I know you all know that, and I was well aware of the fact. So I decided, okay, you know, I'm going to play out these different scenarios that they're going to be throwing my way so I know how to, you know, duck and dodge and weave through this maze, and I'll get out that front door a free man, and I'll walk back to Hamilton, New Jersey, and prove how badly I want to stay sober to mommy and daddy, given that they haven't already changed the locks. And so I walked into my counselor's office, and I sat down and said, hey, Donnie, I just want to let you know, thank you for everything you've done. Take care of these guys over here. They're real screwed up. Me, I know the solution. It's AA. I'm gonna get going now. I'm going to go back to Hamilton, New Jersey. You know, if I get there in 18 hours, I'll be there in time to make my home group. And he said, you have a home group there? I said, oh, yeah, Hamilton, New Jersey, my home group. Friday nights, Sunday nights, it's a great group of guys. And he said, really, you're a home group member? I said, well, you know, they might not realize, but I absolutely am. He said, you don't have a commitment there? I said, well, not yet, but I'm planning on getting one as soon as I get out of here. Because I know, you know, commitment, home group, sponsor steps, do them. And I promise, I'm going to do that this time. I'm going to exert my will that much harder. Just, you know, I obviously wasn't trying hard enough before, but I mean business this time. And he said, really? He said, who's picking you up from here again? And I said, well, no one. I already told you I'm going to prove how badly I want to stay sober by walking back to Hamilton from here. And he said, well, you haven't thought of the idea that maybe you prove to your family and friends how badly you want to stay sober by staying here another 20-some days? And, you know, in all the rehearsing I had done in my mind about what he was going to say and what I was going to say in rebuttal and his statement back to me and how I was going to shoot that down, I had never really come across, you know, the option that he might present to me staying there in this facility to prove how badly it is I want to stay sober. And so he caught me a little off guard, but, you know, I chalked it up to the detox meds and his Jedi mind tricks that he learns in Rehab 101. And, you know, he won't fool me again. And I said, yeah, but, and he said, no buts. He said, you mind shutting that door back there? And now I knew things were about to get scary. Because, you know, now I was going to have a conversation that no one else was going to hear. And it was going to be one that held depth and weight. And I knew it in the pit of my soul. So I absolutely went over and shut the door behind me. And I took a seat like he asked me to. And again, not what I had planned on doing, but I'm still a little foggy. The Seroquel is strong. And he said, Larry, because let me ask you a question. So what's that third step say? And I said, well, Don, come on, I have 9 rehabs, bro. Third step, I'm going to turn my will and my life over to God. And he said, wrong. I said, well, you didn't let me finish. God, as I understand him, he said, wrong. I said, what are you talking about, Donnie? He said, that third step doesn't say you're going to turn your will and your life over to God. You're not going to be handing out pamphlets on Sunday mornings. You're not going to knock on people's doors asking if they've heard the good word. Are you ready for Jehovah's return? He said, that's not what that third step says. And this struck me by surprise because I was pretty sure that's what that third step says. I thought it said, you know, pick a religion and you better be right. And, you know, I thought the Christians had a pretty cool getup, but short of that, there wasn't much in it that I saw appealing. And he said, Larry, that third step has a word in it that you missed. You overlooked, and it's a very big word. So that third step says we're going to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understand him. And, you know, he told me that turning my will and my life over to the care of something didn't mean that I was dedicating myself necessarily to this one thing. It's that I'm going to put my wants and my desires on the back burner. I'm going to put my idea of how I'm going to run things aside. I'm going to get out of the car. I'm going to leave the keys in the ignition. I'm going to walk around to the front and get in the passenger side seat and let someone else get in the driver's seat and take control for a little bit. And, you know, even though he explained this to me as gently and delicately and eloquently as he possibly could, there was some resistance in me. And so when he said, Larry, are you willing to turn your will and your life over to the care of myself in this facility for the next 20-some days, everything in my being wanted to say no and run. I wanted to say thanks, but no thanks, and turn left and get out of there as quickly as possible. And one of the first AA miracles that I've experienced hit me that day when I opened my mouth to say so, and the words okay came out. And it was not what I intended to say. As a matter of fact, I had that finishing line, that knockout punch, planned in my mind from back in my detox room of what I was going to say when he asked me to stay. And I opened my mouth to tell him exactly where he could put his care and protection, and I open my mouth and the words okay come out. And that floored me because that was not what I intended to say. And I broke into tears right then and there. This grown-ass, 25-year-old, red-blooded American male, fine specimen of a human being that I thought I was. I broke down and cried like a little baby. And he comforted me and said, I get it. It's all right. He assured me that he was at one point where I was at that moment. And he promised that he would show me how to get where he was now, because it was obviously where I wanted to be. And so, you know, from that point on, I was a perfect little AA, and they were thinking about putting a story in the back of my book, and I've been told numerous times over and over again, second coming of Bill. No, I'm absolutely kidding. I'm selfish and self-centered to the core, and as soon as I got in the passenger side seat, I put on my seatbelt and pulled up my GPS and said, I think this is the best way to go. And, you know, when they'd want to turn left, I'd grab the wheel to turn right, because I'm pretty sure I know what's best. And so from the very beginning, I started to balk. But, you know, there was that moment of lack of defiance that crept in. And, you know, it was just enough to plant a mustard seed's worth of willingness in me. And that's all I needed at the beginning to commence on this journey. And so, you know, right away I start saying, yeah, but, which is always my go-to. And when it was suggested that I move to a sober house in southern New Jersey, right outside of Atlantic City, I said, yeah, that sounds like a great idea, except there's this place in York, Pennsylvania. Adam there, he's a great dude. I love him. I know he would love to have me back. And I really think that I can't get sober in New Jersey. I think I would do best doing out here. I understand, Donnie, I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of you for the next 20-some days. But I'm just saying, maybe we check out one of my ideas. You know, much like the drummer saying, hey, you guys want to try one of my songs? And but they appeased me and they said, yeah, sure, Larry, we'll look into that. And so there we go. My mind was made up. I'm going to go to this sober house in York, Pennsylvania. And, you know, a power greater than myself had to step in. And my PO said, Larry, when you go to York, Pennsylvania, or anywhere outside the great state of New Jersey, we tend to lose you. You tend to wind up homeless, eating out of McDonald's trash cans with track marks and you know, arrest records all over the place. So we think it would be best if you were not allowed to leave the state of New Jersey. And I put a damper on my plan, so I let go of the wheel a little bit, and I walked back to Donnie's room, and I said, hey, Donnie, you know what? What was I thinking? I'm so sorry. A couple days ago, I said I would turn my will and my life over to the care of you, and here I am so stupidly going to try to take back control. I'm sorry. I totally forgot. You're in control. What was the name of the place in South Jersey you want me to go to? And he said, well, nice try, dickhead. I talked to your PO also, and but yeah, no, you made the decision to turn your will and whatever. So here's the number. And so I called, I interviewed at this place, and they said, yeah, sure, you know, we'll give you a shot. And thank God for that, because, you know, I don't look good on paper. I don't look good in the mirror either, but I don't look good on paper, especially when it came to early sobriety. So the fact that they said, oh, well, have you ever been in one of these houses before? And I said, you know, like one or two or six times. And they said, well, have you ever been to, I guess you've been to treatment a couple times. Yeah, you know, a couple plus eight. And he said, well, what are you trying to do differently this time? And I really had no better answer except, oh, I'm gonna work the steps and then get the sponsor and you know, the home group and the commitment. And you know, for whatever reason, God saw fit that this place accept me. And so I moved into a house that was a half hour away from the town I grew up in, which isn't all that bad, except, you know, you don't have a car. It's hard to get back to the family that you terrorize without them willingly picking you up and bringing you back. And, you know, that is what it is. So anyway, I'm all set to get out this Saturday. And again, I pull up my map on GPS and say, hey, Donnie, I got a great idea. Saturday, you want me to get out? Why don't I get out on Friday? And I'll go back home, you know, have one last night with the family, gather a couple of my things. And then I'll move into the house on Saturday. You know, I got to get myself packed up. And Donnie informed me that my mother let him know that my trash bags were just as I had left them, and my clothes would be there, available for pickup Saturday morning on my way to the sobriety house. And I thought that was a little embarrassing. But I said, okay, whatever. And you know, with some misgiving, he consented to letting me go back to my parents' house that night under two conditions. A, that I move into this sober house the following morning, and B, that I get to a meeting that night. And I said, well, that's great. Friday night in Hamilton. That's my home group. He said, it's not your home group until you ask them if you can join. I said, okay, whatever. Okay, Friday night, the group that's going to be my home group. This is perfect. I'll get out. I'll go there. Great. And, you know, he said, yeah, and you move into that house tomorrow. I said, absolutely. So I get out that night, and I'm telling my parents, you know, okay, this is what I'm going to do, and this is what I'm going to do. And you're going to need to drop me off over here. You're probably going to need to get me a half a carton of cigarettes at least, because you know, it'll be a little while till I get a job. You don't have to give me the car right away, but I will take your Schwinn if you don't mind. I mean, I could pedal probably to a couple meetings. And my dad didn't even humor me. He said, Larry, your cousin Jesse called, and he'd like to talk to you. And I called him, and he had a couple years sober at the time. And he said, Larry, you know, I was really, really thinking about you today. And I called your dad and found out that you were just getting out of treatment again. And, you know, I'd like to take you to a meeting tonight. I said, Jesse, that's amazing. You know, I was planning on going to this Hammond to me. I would like to take you to a meeting tonight. And so, you know, we discussed that him having a car and me not, it would probably be easier for him to take me to a meeting rather than me to take him. So he said, yeah, how about I pick you up at this time? And I said, yeah, that's great. And we'll go over to Hammond. He said, no. There's just meeting in Blackwood I want to take you to. And, you know, I'm no cartographer, but I realized that Hamilton was dead set in the middle of Blackwood and this house I was moving into outside of Atlantic City. You know, Hamilton was a half hour from Atlantic City, and Blackwood was a half hour from Hamilton. And, you know, that means it's going to be an hour away from the place I'm moving to. And my counselor told me I needed to get a fellowship of people. I needed to get a sponsor and a home group and a commitment. And I'm going to be living all the way over here, and you want me to go to a meeting all the way over here. And, I mean, how's God going to arrange for that to happen? I mean, I understand the guy makes the grass grow and you know, the flowers bloom and he invented the supernova, but I'm going to be an hour away from the place I'm living at. Do you really think that I'm going to be able to meet someone who might be able to hook me up? And you know, I tell my sponsor all the time that the only limitations God has are the ones I put on him. Because, you know, I went to a meeting in Blackwood that night, hemming and hauling and stomping my feet like a little child, saying, yeah, but this wasn't my plan. And I got there and I did what I was told to do, and I raised my hand. I said, I'm new. My name's Larry. I just got out of treatment center and I'm moving into a house in Summers Point, New Jersey. If anyone happens to know anyone in the area who might be able to help me out, would you please mind sharing their number with me after the meeting? I don't think I worded it quite as eloquently as that, but I got the point across apparently, because God saw fit to have someone there who raised his hand next and said, Larry, I don't crosstalk at meetings, but I just happened to get out last weekend from that house that you're moving into. And there's this guy named Bruce. I'd like to give you his number. Give him a call and I'm sure he'll be able to get you some rides to meetings. And that's all I needed to hear. Someone who's going to give me a ride to a meeting. Someone who's going to make it easier for me to recover. Someone who will do for me what I'm not willing to do for myself. Because I'm a sucker for pain. I stub my toe. I want an Oxy 80. And I'm not going to walk half a block to a meeting if someone's offering to pick me up and drive me. It just is ludicrous. So I said, oh, that's great. I'll give this guy a call. Wait, what'd you say? His name was Bob. Bruce. Okay, Bruce. Okay. And so I don't know what was said the rest of the meeting. I do know I was a little pissed off when we had to sit around and fellowship afterwards. I just spent an hour and gave you guys a buck of my hard-earned parents' money. And now you want me to hang out and talk with you and smoke cigarettes that aren't the brands that I'm used to? I don't know about this. So I got out and I stomped my feet. Can we go? No, you got to get this guy's number. Get this guy's number. And, you know, finally I get back home. And I walk in my room, and my mom wasn't asleep on the couch. Her purse sure as hell wasn't on the couch either. That was upstairs with her, locked in her room. You know, there wasn't some grand ceremony awaiting me when I came back from my first meeting out of treatment. And so, you know, I packed my things up, and I took those black trash bags to Summers Point the next morning, and I moved into this house, and I picked up the phone at about like 5 o'clock, and I dialed the number of a stranger I had never met, and the voice on the other line seemed like a very scary and intimidating individual. And I said, hi, my name's Larry. I got your number from so-and-so at this meeting, and I was told that, you know, I got this thing called alcoholism, and I hear you have it too, and, you know, if yours doesn't go away, mine doesn't go away, maybe we can get together and go to a meeting sometime. And he said, oh, well, that's great. And all of a sudden, his voice changed, and he got excited. He said, well, that's perfect timing, because I happen to be going to my buddy Benny's house tonight. We're actually, a group of us, we're going there, and we're going to have dinner. And after dinner, we're going to go over here, and his fiance is speaking at this meeting. And then afterwards, we'll probably go back to Benny's and have a little bit of dessert and, you know, fellowship afterwards. And you know, tomorrow morning, there's a 7:30 Big Book meeting Sunday morning in this area. And that gives us just enough time to hit Wawa and get coffee on our way to the 10 o'clock meeting at ACYP. And so your game, right? And I, whoa, slow your roll, Skippy. I had to ask for a ride to a meeting sometime in the near future. If your alcoholism didn't go away and mine didn't go away, I'm still pretty sure maybe I'll be able to solve mine on my own. And you already had me going to 3 meetings and 2 fellowshipping events. And that's not quite what I signed up for. I tried to make up some excuse. I said, well, you know, I would love to, but I got a lot of unpacking to do. And he said, well, you know, the trash bags will be there when you get done. And I get a little pissed off. How does everyone know about these trash bags? And so I said, okay, fine, I'll let you pick me up. So I heard somewhere that, you know, letting someone help me is saving their life. And, yeah, that's the type of guy I am. I like to help people out. So, yeah, come on, pick me up. And so we went to this meeting. I don't remember a single thing that was said while I was there. I remember a redhead sitting around this area, and she was kind of cute. And there was a blonde over here. And, you know, I was interested in doing step work at that moment. And I was actually going to ask her to take me through the steps. Well, maybe the 13th one, primarily. But again, God had this other idea, and I was in the passenger seat, so I went upstairs to smoke a cigarette. Just go figure, it was a meeting in the basement of a church at night. So I go upstairs, and I asked this guy who had picked me up if I could bum a cigarette from him. He said, yeah, sure, he gives me a merit 100. I'm like, Jack, come on, bro, I've spoken knockoff Newports and 305s or whatever down in Miami. So and you're giving me this smooth thing. But I graciously said, can I have a lighter? And he hit me back with the oldest joke in the book, which was, yo, you want me to smoke it for you too? And I came right back at him with, will you take me through the steps? What? And you know, he welled up with tears. He said, oh my God, I'd be honored to. I, as a matter of fact, I was hoping you would ask. We have all these people here. Me? You want me? I would love. No. He said, well, I got to ask you. I got to ask you 3 things. Do you want to get over drinking for good? I told him, absolutely. It means so much more than yes. And he said, and you're willing to do anything to stay sober? Again, absolutely. And he said, is there anything you're not willing to do? And I said, absolutely not. And he said, well, then, I suggest we get started right away. I said, right away? He said, right away. I said, I haven't even finished the merit yet. He said, no, don't worry. They're discussing. You won't miss it. He said, we're gonna get you started on step work right away. And my book's downstairs. Larry, those people right over there. And I looked and I said, oh, you mean standing next to the redhead? He said, yeah, well, you know, avoid her at all costs and go to those people behind her and gather up some numbers. Ask those men over there for their numbers. And I thought, damn. Here I was, I asked this guy to be my sponsor. I figured he would be the one to solve my problem, to get me sober. And obviously, I have asked the wrong person, because the one with the power to get me sober is that guy over there. Whatever, at least he was kind enough to point him out to me and not waste my time. So I went over there and I got the numbers and I did the whole, oh, you know, Bruce over there said I should get your number. And, you know, a little puppy dog in my tail wagon, I came back to him with like 4 or 5 numbers in my Obama phone. And he said, that's great. I said, so now what? He said, well, now what? I want you to go those people over there. And I said, oh, you mean next to the cute blonde? And he said, again, you know, serpentine around her and get those guys' numbers. And about this time, I'm thinking exactly what you're thinking, which is, what team does this guy bat for? Because I'm much interested in the redhead and the blonde's numbers than these old, decrepit men. But, you know, he's running the show right now. I'm in the passenger seat. And besides, my Obama phone doesn't have Google Maps. So I decided, okay, I'll take his lead. And I go over and I get these guys' numbers. And I do this for what seems like an hour or an eternity. And I come back with like 50 or 60 or half a dozen phone numbers. And I say, well, what now? He says, what now? He goes, I want you to give these guys a call. I said, all of them? He goes, not all of them, not all of them. We'll start with 3 of them. I said, why don't you give 3 of these guys a call tomorrow and, you know, see how their day's going. I said, oh, that's great. So, you know, he said, well, whoa, what are you getting so excited about? I said, well, you know, I get to call these people and they're going to help me, right? He goes, well, yeah, I guess in a way. I said, oh, that's perfect. Because, you know, I got a lot going on at this house that I need to get off my shoulders. And he said, what are you talking about? I said, well, first of all, the guy that I'm rooming with reeks to high heaven, doesn't ever wear deodorant. I swear to God, I literally leave the 9 of my deodorants in like ascending height order on my shelf, hoping that maybe he'll get the hint and, like, you know, rub some underneath. And he doesn't ever do it. swear to God, he doesn't do it. And he says, wait, what are you saying? And I said, and then there's the guy, that sneaky son of a, he's over there in the other room, and he's constantly eating my ramen noodles. And he says, your ramen noodles? I said, yeah, my mom got me this whole big pack. Apparently she didn't trust me with her credit card or money for groceries, so she bought me a big pack of ramen noodles, and that's, I mean, I ate out of the McDonald's trash can, so this is kind of beneath me. And so I haven't even touched it, but suddenly the packs keep going away, dwindling one by one, ever so slowly, and I see this kid in the basement, and he's shoving his face full of my ramen noodles, and you know, I just got to get this off my chest. And he said, whoa. He said, you are absolutely not going to call these men and waste their time, take moments from their lives that they could be doing productive things with to complain about your tiny little problems. I said, but wait, Bruce, I am the most important person. You said it. They said it in the meeting. They said the newcomer is the most important person in any meeting. And he quickly put me in place, said, Larry, you know what? 30 days ago in that treatment center, you may have been the newcomer. He said, you know, yesterday when you got out of that treatment center and you went to a meeting and raised your hand and said you had just gone out, you may have been a newcomer. He said, today you live in a recovery house. You've done this thing before. You now have a sponsor. You now have a newly formed network of men that you can call and rely on. You're no longer the newcomer. Your job is to show the guy who's sick and suffering and trembling in the back of the meeting, you know, the sneaker aisle with the sneakers, the slippers, the loafers, and the flip-floppers. He said, that guy back there, that's the one that you're going to go up. Now, nothing against you guys. Those are the comfortable seats, and I'm sure you have a breeze out there. That's not what I meant. Those are the guys who are the newcomers who you're going to extend your hand out to and say, hey, you know, you're struggling getting 2 or 3 days. I'll show you how to get the fourth. He says, no, you're not going to call these people and complain about your little self-entitled issues and your tiny problems. He said, you're going to call them and ask them how their day's going. You're going to call them and get to know them. You're going to talk to these men, and you're going to find out what it is that you could possibly do to be of service to them. And what I didn't realize at the time was that he was doing two things. The first, he was helping me to get outside myself, helping me to branch out to other people, and to build up a fellowship of people that would be there by my side that I could lean on if and when the day did come that I needed them most. But the other thing that he was doing for me that I didn't realize at the time was that he was introducing me to step two. You know, I had admitted step one when I came out of that rehab and I got this number and I called and asked for help. I admitted right then and there that I couldn't do this on my own anymore and that I needed assistance. And you know, step two, as he showed me, was that I recognized something in these people, something about them that said, you know, their whole deportment shouted that here was a person with a solution. And I saw step two in these men. I saw step two in the people that came and I built a fellowship with. I saw something in them that was not in me. I saw a solution that they offered, and I came to believe that it might just work for me. And you know, getting back in that car and going back to Benny's house and laughing and joking and having a couple sweets, I was consummating step three by, you know, not trying to run the show and getting out of my own way for a little bit and letting God orchestrate all the magnificent things that he will as soon as I stop trying to rule the show. And so, you know, that was my introduction to what AA had to offer if I was willing to accept it. And, you know, throughout this process, I've come to realize that me running my show is a lot like what the doctor's opinion talks about, where I'm still taking all those old pieces of my life and wondering why they don't fit together right. In the doctor's opinion, it says that in nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. And what I didn't realize I was doing for so long was I wasn't trying to recreate my life. You know, I was trying to take all those old puzzle pieces, all those old building blocks of my life that kept falling down. I tried to restructure them in the exact same form and pattern that I had before. And so, you know, I would start with this shaky foundation based on self and self-centeredness. And I'd take all these pieces of my life, like, you know, the job and the girl and the car and you know, this and that. And I'd pile them all up on top of each other. And what happened? Well, they always fell down. And, you know, so I would gather up those pieces again, and I'd insist I was going to fare better this time. And I'd stack them up with even more precision and an even gentler hand. And I'd sometimes get the pieces to stack higher than they had before, but they inevitably always fell. And what I come to realize about this process and in relying upon my Creator is that, you know, He's going to be the one to determine what pieces of my old life get put back into this puzzle and back into this this set of building blocks that I'm organizing. And so, you know, I got to get rid of that shaky foundation. I had to have a new foundation. My roots needed to grasp new soil. And, you know, built upon a foundation of God and my understanding of Him, I'm able to take some of those pieces from the past and start building with them again. And there's plenty of pieces that are still sitting by the wayside. And it's not for me to judge whether they're going to be put back into the structure or not. A lot of them have remained on the side, and there's been plenty of new pieces I've been introduced to. And it's up to me to remain willing and open and humble enough to let God dictate what pieces are going to be put into this structure next, in what order. And so, you know, the structure gets awfully shaky sometimes, and it's usually when I insist on taking this piece over here that God has not seen fit to bring back into this building, this new and triumphant arch, which we're building to pass through to freedom. And I insist on putting that piece back in there that things start getting a little bit shaky. And, you know, God will let me do that. When I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of Him, I was using my free will to decide to align myself with God's will versus my self-will. You know, God has not taken that free will from me. He will let me grab hold of that wheel and make however big a mess I want to. And He's always there waiting for me with open arms to welcome me back, to show me which pieces need to be cast aside and show me which ones need to be built with. And I'm so grateful that I have currently developed an awareness of not 24/7, believe me, not 24/7, of what God is and is not, and what God wants and does not want for me. And you know, it's not always the case. I absolutely love to take my will back. I love to exert myself. I love to say, yeah, He could get me sober and perform all these other miracles, but is He really going to help me be happy at work? I mean, won't I just be happy once I get rid of this person? And you know, when that person that I was complaining about happened to leave and go to another store, I thought, thank God you're finally listening to me. You're answering my prayers. Now I can continue to be happy. But that was not the case. You know, this person left, the person I thought was the problem, and God replaced them with one of you guys, with a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, who's been able to hold up that mirror to me and say, hey, Larry, all these tiny things that you swore were the problem with this guy, why don't you take a look at what part of self is usually disturbing you when you find something disturbing in someone else? And so, you know, what I thought was the problem was person A over here was not the case. And as a matter of fact, God put person B over there to show me that it was something in me that absolutely needs to change. And this is just a small example of how God works in ways that I don't see coming. You know, if I could see God's master plan from a mile away, I wouldn't think it was all that great. You know, I don't go to the magic show and compliment the magician on what tricks he performed that I also know. I go up there and I say, damn, I didn't see that coming. I have no idea how you did it. Those are the ones that blow me away. And that is the way I view God's handiwork in my life today. I never see it coming. I think it's over here, and it happens to be in this hand, palmed, and with a rubber chicken in the pant pocket and something up his sleeve, and it's always greater than I'd ever imagined. And I'm just so grateful for the life that I have today. You know, one last thing I would like to share on God consciousness in my life. A buddy of mine he said this, and I wrote it in the back of my big book, then forgot that he said it, so when I read it, I was like, damn, I'm really deep and spiritual, and then I read his initials at the end of it. But he said, you know, a spiritual awakening, God doesn't show up. I'm aware that He's been there all along. And I'm like, damn, you know, that is some powerful stuff right there, because that's exactly what my spiritual awakening has looked like to me. So I'd like to end with a quote, if you don't mind. It's a quote from a movie. It's a very spiritual movie that I'm sure many of you have seen. The title is Pulp Fiction. And I... You've seen it, so you okay. So you know, in this movie, there's a scene where two of the main characters, Samuel L. Jackson and John Travolta, are standing over a briefcase with a green, gold glowing light coming out of it, and they're very astonished by what's in this case. And all of a sudden, a guy pops out of the bathroom that they didn't know was there, and he has this huge hand cannon and unloads six rounds at them, and all of those six rounds miss them, and the holes are all in the wall behind them to prove it. And the two of them look at each other, and they do what gangsters do, and they blow the guy away, and then they stop to analyze the situation. And John Travolta turns to Samuel L. Jackson and says, "We got lucky right there." Samuel L. Jackson says, "Whoa, whoa, luck had nothing to do with it, my friend. That was divine intervention." Right? John Travolta says, "Divine intervention. You really think the hand of God came down and stopped these bullets?" Samuel Jackson says some real gangster shit. He says, "Yo, you're getting me all wrong. It doesn't matter whether the hand of God came down to stop those bullets or by some strange coincidence they happened to miss us. The fact of the matter is, I felt the presence of God. And that, my friend, is all that matters. And, you know, that's the way my sobriety and my God consciousness looks. I can't tell you that this is certainly happening because it's God's plan for me. But I can certainly tell you when it's not his plan for me. And you know, when it is, I'm able to step back and say, well, he was there all along, even when I doubted him, even when I didn't think he could possibly have a hand in this. I come out on the other end and I realize he had been there all along. And I'm so grateful to you guys for opening my eyes to that and helping me to become aware of that. So thank you very much for inviting me here tonight. I appreciate it, and God willing, I'll keep coming back. So thank you.